Hello and welcome to the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 8th of October 2017. My name is TRP Watson, and this time I'm joined by Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Oslo, which was at the Littleton part of the National Theatre, but is now being moved to the Harold Pinter Theatre in the West End. This is an award-winning play by J.T. Rogers, which details the back-channel negotiations that were pivotal in the making of the 1990s Oslo Peace Accords between the Palestinian Liberation Organization and Israel. It was off Broadway in 2016. It was on Broadway earlier this year, then came to the National with a completely different cast. It did win the 2017 Tony Award for Best Play and Best Featured Actor. The cast here includes Philip Arditi, Paul Policarpu, Lydia Leonard, Thomas Arnold, Nabil Eliwahabi, Toby Stevens, Paul Hertzberg, Geraldine Alexander, Jonah Lotan, and Howard Ward, amongst many other people I've probably missed. It concerns a couple, Tej Rod Larson and Mona Yule, a husband and wife, Tej is rather ambitious, and played by Toby Stevens here. He thinks he can get people together and get people negotiating about the Israeli-Palestinian problems, and he thinks he can make some kind of negotiation happen. When the play opens, his wife has just started at the Norwegian Foreign Ministry in a fairly senior post, and she's not the minister, but she's a civil servant, and he uses her good offices and her contacts to try to set up these negotiations. At first, these negotiations are between senior members of the PLO, but they're only between a couple of Israeli professors. The Israeli professors are there because it's technically illegal in Israel for any minister or civil servant to talk to the PLO, so it makes it a little bit difficult for any negotiations to take place. But Tej Rod Larson and Mona Yule set up these professors and these senior Palestinian negotiators in a small guest house, we're told, in Norway, where they have nice home cooking and are rather charmed by it, and the negotiations begin to become really quite successful. Meanwhile, Mona Yule is trying to get more senior people from Israel to take part in it and to try to work out the difficulties between the Prime Minister of Israel, who's Isaac Rabin at the time, and his foreign minister, Shimon Peres. And because it's a coalition, you have those two people not really liking each other and being rivals for power. So if something comes from one of them, the other one might not accept it. So they're playing that rather difficult background game. But eventually they get a rather more senior person to come in and talk to them. His name is Uwe Savier, and he's played by Philip Arditi. He begins to build up quite a good relationship with the senior Palestinian negotiator, Ahmed Khoury, I think it is, played by Peter Policarpu, and they begin to bond, they begin to understand each other. They still are at odds with each other, but slowly they realise that they have to come to some kind of arrangement, and eventually they do. We don't really get the details of the agreement and all the arrangements, but what we do get is a strong feeling of they are success, that they're bonded, and they are agreeing. We even have a situation where the senior Palestinian negotiator and the senior Israeli negotiator discover that their daughter has the same name. Now, that wouldn't be uncommon, because names are very similar in that area. Wouldn't be unknown for names to have it, but it is a form of bonding. Unfortunately, of course, that was also used as a plot device recently in a movie called Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, and that people laughed at it then, so I couldn't help remembering it at that point. It worked very well here, and it was very believable here, and in fact, it's actually true, so in this case, that they bonded over a daughter's name, or we're told it's true, because they do talk about the real future of people. The one thing that you do begin to realise, and it is mentioned in this play, is that the reason for the eventual, well, you would have to say failure of it, or partial failure of the Oslo Accords, is rooted in here. They mention it, but they don't focus on it, and perhaps because they wouldn't have known it at the time, and this is part of the reality of this. It's not for the 2020 hindsight. But of course, the major problem with the PLO was that they were exiled from anywhere near Israel. They were based in Tunisia, and because the occupied areas, places like Gaza and the West Bank, They couldn't openly operate there, and certainly the leadership couldn't be there. And that meant the PLO leadership was out of touch with the Palestinian people. And so when the PLO came back in and were allowed to be there after the Oslo Accords, they weren't actually liked by the Palestinian people who had been in the West Bank and Gaza, and other groups such as Hamas went up against them. So this is why we have the situation we have now in Gaza and to a certain extent in the West Bank, where you have Hamas, who represent the Palestinian people, who never were asked to sign any accords, and you have the Palestinian Authority, who grew out of the PLO, who of course are part of the Oslo Accords. So there is that conflict, and that conflict that we now have grew in part out of this. But it's not dealt with here. They're not really doing the 2020 hindsight here. They're stating the facts as were known at the time. Although, as I say, there is a brief mention that perhaps the PLO are out of touch in Tunis. They're out of touch with the real people. And the seeds of the problem is that it's the PLO that wants to be recognised. This is a very finely put together play and a very fine production directed here by Bartlett Scheer. The Littleton, they took full advantage of the very big Littleton stage to present a rather simple rooms. I mean, we're really usually just in offices or in hotel rooms or in the lounge of this small guest house or country house where they met up. And of course, taking advantage of the big Littleton stage, they're able to isolate people so that they can have private conversations. Maybe it differed slightly when it's moved to the Harold Pinter Theatre. I thought this was, you know, a strong production, very interesting piece of history, and worth looking people up and finding out more about it. What did you think about it, Gareth?
I enjoyed it very, very much indeed. Going sort of back to the story, I mean, I think the interesting thing about this Norwegian sociologist who sort of runs a kind of think tank, Turge, is that, I mean, his big idea really was to focus on building relationships and building trust and informality. And that was a striking contrast to the parallel talks that were going on at the time, which were very formal. They were loads of people, conference centers. And basically, you know, what he realized is you never made progress in that kind of setting where you had a chance of making progress here. And I think he also realized that if you could get the Israelis to talk direct to the PLO, which he did eventually manage to do, then you were going to the heart of the sort of decision makers. I agree with you in the sense that part of the reason for the unraveling of the Oslo Accord was that when the PLO got back to Palestine and created the Palestinian Authority, they had less legitimacy and eventually were effectively replaced by Hamas. But I think more importantly, it unraveled because individual people who didn't agree with the accord on both sides actually instigated atrocities to undermine it. And it was undermined more by atrocities where people on both sides were killed than it was by the legitimacy of the PLO once it got back into Palestine. So that would be my take on that. And I think, I mean, what's extraordinary about the true story is that, you know, there were only 7 rounds of talks, each lasting a few days. But in those 7 rounds of talks, using this informality and this focus on relationships and trust, which clearly were built, and probably also the sort of made food and drink that they both shared a passion for, they did make extraordinary progress. And then when Rabin was in Stockholm, in a 7-hour phone conversation with Arafat, with interpreters at the other end, they were able to actually conclude the deal, which was put to the Israeli cabinet and unanimously accepted by them. So it is an extraordinary true story, and I think it's told really, really well here. And I think J.T. Rogers, who we haven't seen that much of here, I mean, I've seen The Overwhelming and I've seen Blood and Gifts. Blood and Gifts similarly takes a historical situation in Afghanistan. That actually started as a short play within The Great Game, Tricycle's kind of look at Afghanistan over 150 or so years, and then became a full play, Blood and Glyphs at the National Theatre. And what he showed there is that he has this gift for taking historical events and without in any way taking them lightly or treating them in anything other than the respect they deserve, he turns them into really, really good entertainment that is thought-provoking, that does make you go away and research and read and look what actually happened, but actually for the 2 or 3 hours you're in the theatre, it entertained you. And I think the only other playwright I think that's got a similar knack is James Graham, who's got 2 shows in West End together at the moment. But I mean, he's got a very similar gift, although his subjects tend to be much closer to home, and he's focusing much more on sort of recent British history, as it were, and perhaps less significant events than something like a global peace accord. But what Rogers does is he does take these real events and turn it into very enjoyable, very entertaining, but also very thought-provoking drama. And here, you know, with great objectivity. I don't think he takes any sides here. You know, he does show the real passionate and emotional roots for this conflict that does come through in the emotions of the participants. But he also, you know, shows the impossibility, the difficulty of finding a common ground here, but also shows that there are things they have in common and they do probably want to find a solution if they possibly can, because nobody wants to be in this perpetual state of war. So I thought it was a very, very good play indeed. I saw it in the Harold Pinter Theatre, so I was kind of wondering the other way around. You know, I wonder what it's like in a bigger stage. But it certainly fitted that stage very well. The clever thing about the design for me is the projections onto the wall, and the projections change the setting so they can kind of project what might be on the wall, sort of plasterwork or whatever, to create a different room. But also they project scenes of what's happening in the world outside the talk, so that kind of takes us back to what's happening out there in the real world. So that was actually very clever. I think what makes the play, though, is a set of absolutely fine performances. Toby Stevens, although I wasn't convinced whether he was trying to speak English with a Norwegian accent or not, because it seemed to change, I thought was very good as Turge. And Lydia Leonard, who I've seen less of, extremely good as his wife Mona. And they're virtually on stage for almost all of the 3 hours. Peter Polycarpou proves again he's got incredible range. I last saw him in a musical in Southwark Playhouse playing a sort of New York mechanic and singing about his sort of lack of fulfillment in life and his hopes for his children, really. And here he is as the chief negotiator for the PLO, and I thought he was terrific. He's got a much more hardened colleague, Hassan, who's played by Nabil Elouabi, and I think his skill is really a transition, because he is a very sort of hard man, Moscow trained, but then actually kind of melts as the process goes on. And I think that Nabil actually handles that really, really well. These two academics that the Israeli fields at the outset, a kind of bumbling double act, I thought were charmingly played by Paul Hertzberg and Thomas Arnold. And Paul Hertzberg in particular was kind of channeling Stan Laurel, I thought. And there was a reference from one of the PLO guys to Laurel and Hardy at one point in time. Philip Aditi played a really great part in Blood and Gifts, this previous full play that we saw from J.T. Rogers. And here he's great as this kind of very hardline, very abrasive Savio, who is the guy who upgrades the negotiations because he's actually from the Israeli Foreign Office. And then we get this even more aggressive stance from an Israeli-American lawyer, Joel Singer, who I thought was a pitch-perfect performance from E.I.E. Jonah Lotan. And another sort of excellent performance, really. And then finally, the one I'd single out would be Geraldine Alexander, who, in addition to being a Foreign Office official, is also playing the housekeeper, a very sort of lovely, charming housekeeper in this guest house where all the talks take place, really. So I thought it was very objective. I thought it enabled you to sort of see the reasons for the impasse, to see the foundations for the conflict, to see how the informality and the relationship trust building can actually lead to something much more successful than a more formal situation. And even though the result was a partial success, I actually found the play very hopeful. So I thought it was, you know, a real theatrical feast for me, and absolutely to be recommended to anybody for me.
We're now going to talk about Prism at the Hampstead Theatre. This is a new play by Terry Johnson, who also directs, designed by Tim Shortall, and stars Robert Lindsay, Barnaby Kay, Rebecca Knight, and Claire Skinner. It is a story about the cinematographer, Jack Cardiff, who really came to fame by directing an awful lot of Powell and Pressburger's classic films, things like Matter of Life and Death, Back the Scissors, and The Red Shoes. He also then went on to film other things like The African Queen, Barefoot Contessa, and even into the 1980s he was doing things like The Awakening, and even later in life he was doing things like Conan the Destroyer and Rambo, First Blood Part 2. So he had a very wide career, very long career, but this play takes part later in his life when he has begun to suffer from a form of dementia and his memory is getting worse. So what his son and wife do is to recreate a kind of what we would term a man cave, a sort of memorabilia place for him in an old garage. So when we first meet him, we only really see his feet because he introduces the play as the garage door opens. He talks about all the different ratios, things like CinemaScope, also what we think is widescreen, all the different ratios he talks about as the garage door raises until we get to the final one, which is strict Academy ratio, which is 4:3, I believe. So he talks us through that while we're being introduced to his nurse and also his son. Later on, we get introduced to his wife, and we're not entirely sure that it is his wife because she is much younger. She's played by Claire Skinner. They didn't get married until the 1970s. And the nurse is played by Rebecca Knight, who is a working class girl who doesn't necessarily know about some of his classic movies, but slowly, as is the way with these plays, slowly comes to understand them and tries to talk him through them. One of the things that his family are trying to do is to keep him in reality, but she, through her training, says, well, actually, maybe we should indulge in a little bit of his fantasy. So in this sort of man cave set, he has a lot of pictures of some of the women he's filmed, and people like Katharine Hepburn and Marilyn Monroe and other people. And what happens with these pictures is that they sometimes begin to animate, and we get sort of more than just the frozen frame. We get how they were looking at the time. So it's a really quite clever set. It's a set that is capable of animating and really rather well done. At the beginning of the second half, the set actually gets broken apart, and we are on a raft in Africa while Jack Cardiff is shooting the African Queen for John Huston, and he is sitting around with Katharine Hepburn, who is possibly his, we get the impression that she's the one person who resisted him because she was, you know, in a very deep relationship with Spencer Tracy. Well, obviously there were problems with that relationship, and Jack Carter could never get to her. Again, she's played by Claire Skinner. While Barnaby Kaye and Rebecca Knight take on the roles of Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, they're sitting around playing cards, just waiting for the light to be right or waiting for supplies to come back and worrying about whether or not anything is going to survive from this film, because they're filming on location with a very small crew and a crew that keeps disappearing and running away, basically. So they're having a lot of difficulties, and we get a nice conversation, and we get something of a fight between them, because there are times when he switches between the reality there. We get a slightly later scene, which has already been prefigured, where Rebecca Knight is being Marilyn Monroe, and he's filming with her, and he's flirting with her, and news recently there are other interpretations of him, and he gets into a fight, but we've already seen that scene played out, because he had that fight earlier, completely in his imagination, when he was sort of going between the nurse and his son, and not being able to get the reality of the situation. So we sometimes go back into the fantasy. I thought this was a fascinating play. I'm not sure about how accurate it is in any way. I mean, certainly he did live quietly in a small village in Buckinghamshire near a studio. And he did imagine that his wife was Katharine Hepburn, and he did live in a world of fantasy towards the end of his life. So we're probably fairly accurate, and fairly accurate for Terry Johnson, who is, in my mind, notorious for bending the facts and twisting the facts. But I thought it was an interesting play, maybe not a great one, but certainly something which takes you back and, again, makes you go back to the Wikipedia and look things up. It's well performed. Claire Skinner's Katharine Hepburn is extremely good, I thought. But I don't think it's the greatest play, but certainly it was worth a watch. What do you think, Gareth?
I think worth a watch is my summary, although I think I'm probably just a little bit less positive than you about it. We're more used to seeing Terry Johnson's directing work these days than plays he's written. From a Q&A in the programme, that critical receptions have sort of become a bit of a problem for him in terms of writing plays. And a biographical play about a cinematographer doesn't seem particularly promising. And even though Jack Cardew's career does almost read like a history of the 20th century cinema, one does kind of wonder, but is it something for the stage? And it seems to have been suggested by the leading man, by Robert Lindsay. So Terry Johnson has kind of dramatized the biography and indeed Robert Lindsay's idea. And as you say, we're at the end of his life. We're at his home with his wife and son, and I thought was a PA rather than a nurse. I thought she was some sort of assistant, some secretary, some PA. And of course, he has dementia, and therefore it's all about recollections and reflections, and he appears to be attempting to write a biography, or has attempted to write a biography. The opening scene you mentioned with the garage door I thought was absolutely brilliant. I just thought it was a great way to start, where he uses this garage door to sort of tell you the history of all the sort of screen shapes and sizes. I thought that was just brilliant. And the scene which just starts at the end of Act One, but takes up a chunk of the first part of Act Two, where we flash back to the filming of the African Queen in Kenya, I thought was also absolutely brilliant. And I thought the transformation of Rebecca Knight, who's the PA stroke nurse, into Lauren Bacall was fantastic. I thought Claire Skinner becomes a brilliant Catherine Hepburn, and Barnaby Kay, of course, as Humphrey Bogart. So I thought the transformations were brilliant, and I thought that scene just made the play for me. Later on, we get Kay and Knight transform again, this time as Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe, and they also do that really well. And this isn't the first play of Terry Johnson's where Marilyn Monroe is a character, of course. My problem with the play is, after the opening scene and before and after this kind of middle point, I thought it was really a bit slight in terms of biographical theatre. And I kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, they may have started by thinking, oh, that's really interesting, let's go for that then. And they come to the conclusion that actually his life wasn't as interesting as they thought it was, and maybe not as stageable as they thought it was. And I think, you know, apart from the fact it can feature lots of incredibly famous people and they can name drop, and there is a hint of perhaps some infidelity with famous people, it wasn't substantial enough for me to make good biographical theatre. That said, four fine performances. I mean, they're all really good. A great design, Tim Shortall, as you mentioned. And, you know, there was enough to make me pleased that I went to see it, which I did on its last day, in fact. But I don't think it's a great play, and I certainly don't think it's one of Terry Johnson's best plays either. But glad I went, I think.
We're now going to talk about The March on Russia, which is at the Orange Tree. It's just close to the Orange Tree. It is a play by David Story, who is probably slightly better known for plays such as This Sporting Life, Home, Changing Room, among other things. It concerns a gathering for the 60th anniversary of a couple, the Passmores. Their three grown-up middle-aged children have all to turn up to celebrate this and get an examination of their life and their families and the relationships they have between the children, but especially between this husband and wife. The reference to the March on Russia is, of course, that Miss Passmore took part in the invasions of Russia that happened in, I think, 1919 or the late 1918, late 1919, where various British and American expeditionary forces went into Soviet Russia to try to help the White Russians, then rather quickly withdrew when they saw it wasn't going to work. And it is a story that Mr. Passmore tells over and over again. This production is directed by Alice Hamilton, and the design is by James Perkins. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, David Story is known more as a novelist, I think, than he is as a playwright, although he did have a particularly productive playwriting period in the late 60s, early 70s, when he did In Celebration, The Contractor, Home, and The Changing Room in quick succession. But we don't really see enough of his plays now, in my opinion. We don't see enough of his plays revived now. I think we did have In Celebration not that long ago in the West End. We did have The Changing Room when the Royal Court was away from home. And we did have Home, I think, with Richard Breers and Paul Eddington, but that again was a fair while ago, as they're both not with us anymore. So it's good to see a David Story play I don't think has been on since it was first mounted, and is much later play. It's a 1989 play. And good to see David Story full stop, really, to be honest. So gold star to the Orange Tree for putting it on, and indeed on this occasion, they've pitched something that the traditional Oratory audience are enjoying very much, whereas some of the stuff they've had lately hasn't gone down quite so well with the Oratory audience. And it's really a play of ageing and family relationships and tension. But notwithstanding a ponderous first half, which I did struggle to maintain attention during, it's actually a very delicate, very sensitive kind of play, and it's got a beautiful, beautiful production here of Malice Hamilton, who's also put together as good a cast as you're likely to get for a play like this, really. So very welcome indeed. I think in the first half, the problem with the play is that, you know, we get some pleasantries, we get a bit of bickering, we get some welcome reunions between the parents and their children, and a bit of nostalgia, but it doesn't really go anywhere else, and it's a longer half than the second half. So by the time you get to the interval, I was just a little bit frustrated, sort of saying, you know, I wanted a bit more meat, I guess, really. And it was a bit Chekhovian, and I'm not a Chekhov fan, so that's probably why. But then the second half's an absolute gem, because what happens in the second half is they've been out for this celebratory lunch for the 60th wedding anniversary, and when they return, and there are lots of home truths and skeletons coming out of cupboards and the unsaid being said. So much more happens, which is an interesting insight into the relationship of the parents, but also the relationship between the parents and the children, and between the children as well. And also tells us about the history. You know, we learn that he's been a miner and got to the point where a lot of miners do, as I know from first-hand experience, are kind of afraid to go down the mine. It becomes something they're forced to do, but don't really want to do anymore, really. So I found that whole second half absolutely wonderful. And the children stay overnight, which they haven't planned to do, because actually all of this kind of upsets the parents. So it does take us through the night into the following morning. I thought it was beautifully acted. You know, we see a fair bit of Ian Gelder, and he's great here as Passmore Dad. And we don't see so much of Sue Wallace, or I certainly haven't seen as much of Sue Wallace. And I thought she was absolutely brilliant as the mum here. She just kind of captured that age and that, you know, the kind of characteristics of a woman of this age, time, and location. A marvellous performance, I thought. And then the three siblings were all beautifully paid, you know, very differently. Colin Tierney, Sarah Belcher, and Connie Walker all give nice characterizations of these three children who have gone in completely different directions and now have completely different lives. So I thought it was, you know, a very welcome revival, notwithstanding the ponderousness of the first half, very much worth seeing, a nicely sort of written play. But above all, I think, just given the beautiful production by Alice Hamilton, a lovely set by James Perkins, where he quite rightly, in a home like this, you know, puts the coal fire centre stage. And I thought that design worked really well. And Sofia Szymeski creates period costumes that kind of continue to evoke this place and this period. It's clearly over now, but I was really, really glad I caught it at the Oratory, and would love to see people reviving David's story a bit more, because I think as British playwrights go of the period of the sort of 60s, 70s into 80s. I mean, I think he's a high quality playwright. So, recommendation for me, but sadly, too late for anyone to go.
Yeah, it's a very interesting play. Reading up about a few things, I mean, read up about Celebration, and of course, Celebration was written 20 years before this, and is set again, a Nottinghamshire mining town, and tells of three brothers who come to visit their parents on their 40th wedding anniversary. So, it's almost a sequel, although it's three brothers sort of in this case it's you know, two sisters and a brother come to visit. So there is a lot of interest here. I mean, I don't tend to complain about anything I see Ian Gelder in. He is always such a fascinating presence, and it's a very interesting sort of microcosm of that kind of life and this family dynamic that he had, and very possibly knew quite a lot about. I mean, you do tend to feel that it comes from somewhere very personal and something that he's interested by. I think Colin Tierney's character features in other works by David Story. I have a feeling one of his novels is something that David Story looked into, that he used a character or a similar character to the Colin Nath played by Colin Tierney in a different novel. So there's a lot of things you could get your teeth into if you're interested in David Story about this. And it is an interesting play. I mean, I agree with you about some slowness in the first half, and they were slowly drip-feeding the children in, essentially. The play comes much more alive when you get much more of the tensions and much more of the anger, the conflicts between the parents, so that they've sort of hidden from everybody else, and that realization that children have that they're going to actually have to come back and look after their parents a lot more because they need a lot more help than they have before. So I keep saying interesting, I hate saying interesting play, but it was a fascinating play and makes you, as you said, hungry for a little bit more David's story in our lives, a little bit more of his plays and what they mean to us and what they can mean to us in the future.
He's a rare sort of working class playwright, really. I mean, you know, that's the thing. We don't see so many of those anymore. And I think that's why it's kind of quite refreshing. And I think you're right. It is more than a touch autobiographical. And I suspect that actually the character of Colin may well also be the focus of the autobiography as well. So I think that it's certainly, I think there is an autobiographical theme running through all his plays. And this is certainly one of them.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page at Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.